Well, hello and welcome to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am sorry for last week, but I was away on the beautiful island of Bute, just off the west coast of Scotland. Anyway, I'm sure you'd like to hear what's going on around the world. So without further ado, this news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. The main headlines from around the world are as follows. It appears that the Nazca's destruction of forests caused their downfall. Experts uncover a celestial connection from the canyons of Southwest America, and a possible Bronze Age burial site is discovered in Oxford. Why the 11th Nordic Bronze Age Symposium is hailed as a great success. A fallen standing stone is found in Cornwall, and at the other end of the scale, a Mesolithic flint is found by an 11-year-old, also in England. Isotope analysis of Bronze Age cattle provides evidence of long-distance connections, and an extinct bison could rewrite Canadian archaeological record. The oldest continuously inhabited place in Britain? Well, after you've heard this story, you can decide. And there's evidence of human habitation on Trinidad 7,000 years ago. Finally, Neanderthals and modern humans got it together. An ancient love-in. Look forward to that story. An ancient civilization brought about its own demise by destroying forests which kept its delicate ecosystem in balance, according to researchers who claim the discovery has important implications for the modern world. Archaeologists examining the remains of the Nazca, who once flourished in the valleys of south coastal Peru, discovered a sequence of human-induced events that led to a catastrophic collapse around 500 CE. David Beresford-Jones of the MacDonald Institute for Archaeological Research at the University of Cambridge said that there was rearrangements of settlement patterns and evidence from human bodies that life expectancy was falling and infant mortality rising, which leads him to believe something terrible happened. The mistakes of prehistory offers important lessons for our own management of the fragile arid areas of the present. In the study published in the journal Latin American Antiquity, the researchers found that the Nazca cleared areas of forest to make way for their own agriculture over the course of many generations. In doing so, the Jorango tree, which once covered what is now a desert area, was gradually replaced by crops such as cotton and maize. But the tree was crucial to the desert's fragile ecosystem, as it enhanced soil fertility and moisture and helped to hold the Nazca's narrow, vulnerable irrigation channels in place. The Nazca eventually cut down so many trees that they reached a tipping point, at which point the arid ecosystem was irretrievably damaged. An El Niño-style flood then occurred, but its impact would have been far less devastating had the forest which protected the delicate desert ecology still been there. The Jorango tree is a remarkable nitrogen-fixing tree, and it was an important source of food, forage, timber and fuel for the local people. It is this ecological keystone species in the desert zone, enhancing soil fertility and moisture, ameliorating desert extremes in the microclimate beneath its canopy, and underpinning the floodplain with one of the deepest root systems of any known tree. The study contradicted a popular view that Native American people always lived in harmony with their environment. Jim Krebiel spent years uncovering why ancient kivas, which are rooms used for religious rituals, why they were built in such remote sites in Utah in the USA. Perhaps, he thought, the site was an observatory, a place to help religious leaders keep track of solstices, time rituals and plantings. A discussion with Barbara Anderek, a professor of astronomy and physics at Ohio Wesleyan, put Krebiel on the path that would help him test his ideas about the remote kivas he visited each summer. One of Anderek's students, Natalie Cunningham, was looking for a senior project in 2008, and she agreed to help. Cunningham had to do a lot of mathematics to go back into the past to see where the sun and moon were at different times, and in the summer of 2008, her and Krebiel went out to Utah to take readings in the field. At one kiva, Krebiel set up his transit and sighted in a gap on the opposite canyon rim where he thought that the winter solstice sun might rise. Instead, he found that the moon rises there during an event called the Major Lunar Standstill, which occurs every 18.6 years. The major standstill occurs when the moon rises and sets in its longest arc across the horizon, the lunar version of the annual summer solstice, when the sun makes its longest arc across the sky. But they also found that the calculations that Cunningham had made in the relatively flat Ohio only went so far in the canyons of Utah. The clifftop Kiva is on a relatively flat plain, with the features on the opposite canyon rim and with the horizon, so calculations were close enough to work there. But they didn't work for Kivas deep inside a canyon, as the canyon rim is high above them, and the sun and moon don't appear to observers at those sites until they're far above the true horizon. So, she found a better model in a book published in 1942 by the US Navy, and she derived an equation that took the arc of the sky into consideration. They returned in October 2008 and re-examined the sites with a spherical trig chart in their hands, and everything fell into place. They found alignments for solstices, equinoxes, and major and minor lunar standstills at 29 sites so far. Kriebel takes sightings only from spots where the cliff dwellers left a sign, such as a spiral carving or a basin chipped out of the rock. He doesn't always find alignments, though, with distinct features in the horizon. About 30% of those sites he'd checked showed none. So there's still room for discussion. However, this is a great example of interdiscipline research and good old-fashioned guesswork. Archaeologists have unearthed what they say could be a prehistoric Bronze Age burial site in central Oxford in England. Experts say important individuals may have been laid to rest at the site of the former Radcliffe Infirmary. Land around the River Thames, known as the River Isis as it passes through Oxford, was often used for prehistoric burial, ritual and social monuments. Finds from the dig are currently undergoing radiocarbon dating. These experts discovered traces of three large ring ditches, which could have been Bronze Age burial sites. A Museum of London Archaeology spokesman said that ring ditches are circular ditches, which are often all that remains of ploughed-out barrows, associated with burials in the later Neolithic and Bronze Age around 4,000 years ago. The Radcliffe Infirmary site is being redeveloped as part of plans for Oxford University's new Radcliffe Observatory Quarter. The 11th Nordic Bronze Age Symposium has been organised by the Institute for Cultural Research and Archaeology at the University of Helsinki in Finland. The theme of the symposium was a changing picture of the period of early metals in the peripheral areas of the Baltic Sphere and in northern areas up to the Arctic Sea. The three-day conference counted about 60 registered participants. The main themes touched upon in the presentation were building a new model of how Bronze Age society in southern Scandinavia was organised, current Bronze Age research in Estonia, past and present interpretation of the early Metal Age and Bronze Age in Finland, the Bronze Age in the Stockholm Archipelago, recent rock art surveys in the Södermanland province, and human sacrifice and corpse ritual in Lithuania. The jaw-drop moment of the conference came when osteologist Lisa Harvig showed pictures of what she'd been doing. She's a PhD student with Niels Linnerup at the Department of Forensic Medicine in Copenhagen. Recently, Danish archaeologists ran a crumbling Neolithic amber bead hoard through a CT scanner before excavating and trying to stabilize them. Now, Lisa is putting entire Bronze Age urn burials through that same scanner. She knows where every piece of bone and bronze is in the urn before she even cuts open the plaster that they've been encased in since being lifted from the ground. She has perfect 3D digital models of the urns that fall apart when you remove the plaster, and she has demonstrated that a lot of the bone fragmentation that has commonly been assumed to be due to the dedicated crushing and grinding by mourners is actually simply due to the brittleness of burnt bones whose organic components have leached away over the millennia. Big bones are sitting in the urns, each fragment in place, but they fall apart when you try and lift them. As Lisa put it, the one who does the ritual crushing is in fact her when she empties the urn. So, how can a PhD student in archaeology afford the use of this sort of high-tech equipment? Well, it turns out the technology is developing so fast that the hospitals frequently swap their CT scanners for newer ones. The used one at the Department of Forensic Medicine makes one slice every 3 millimeters. Not good enough for brain surgery, but perfect for archaeology. Well, if they have another one there, I wouldn't say no to it. I'll give you my address. Sounds like a great conference, though. If you actually want to find out more about it, then all you have to do is go to Google, of course, and put in 11th Nordic Bronze Age Symposium. You'll find a lot more on the site. Earlier this year, archaeologists working on behalf of South West Water have discovered a fallen standing stone at Coit between Trevalga and Trevathy in Cornwall. The 4.5-ton stone is thought to have originally stood upright and is shaped from a large local greenstone with a rounded base and a tapering top. All the artefacts have been left in situ and covered for future generations. Budding archaeologist Samuel Owens uncovered a 10,000-year-old piece of history when he found a fragment of flint in his dad's allotment. The piece has now been identified as being Mesolithic. Samuel, who's only 11 and a pupil at President Kennedy School, had been out with his dad at their allotment in Kerrisley in the West Midlands when they made their discovery. "He just saw it sticking out of the ground," he said, "when my dad was digging. We picked it up and looked up on the internet. They then sent off photographs and it was confirmed that it was from the Mesolithic period. It makes him very, very happy and he would like to find more." Well, wouldn't we all? Samuel and his dad Alan of Halbert Road are involved with the Coventry District Archaeological Society, in particular the group's Coventry Historic Environment Project, looking into areas in the Alesby County and Kerrisley area. Alan, who works as a quality engineer at Coventry Pressworks, thinks the find is further proof that a large part of Greenbelt land near his home should not be used for housing. The council has earmarked the area as a possible site to build thousands of new homes. Alan would like to see more excavation and investigation of the area. He feels there's a lot of history in this place, and it's important that it should be explored rather than just building houses on top of it. Well, hopefully that's exactly what will happen, and hopefully it will allow local people to actually get involved. Hint, hint. The 4,000-year-old barrows at Earthlingborough, Northamptonshire and Gayhurst in Buckinghamshire are famous amongst Bronze Age archaeological sites for their unusual amounts of cattle remains associated with their central human burials. Archaeologists have been puzzled about the meanings since the sites were first excavated in the 80s and 90s. At Earthlingborough, the cattle bones comprise mainly skulls. Were these tokens brought from far away as gifts for the deceased, or did the cows come from a local herd? Well, Jacqueline Towers, an archaeology PhD student at the University of Bradford, tried to solve the mystery by looking at the isotope composition of the cattle's teeth. Some chemical elements occur in heavier and lighter varieties, called isotopes. The proportion between heavy and light isotopes is closely related to environmental factors, such as geology, climate, and also depending on the element. Older rocks will be richer in the heavier strontium isotope, and this feature is passed on to the soils, plants and water. When animals eat locally grown plants and drink water from nearby springs, strontium atoms make their way into the body and then accumulate in teeth and bones, where the heavy light isotope ratio will reflect the local geology. Towers and colleagues sampled several cattle teeth dug from Earthlingborough and Gayhurst barrows and measured their strontium content at the NERC Isotope Geoscience Laboratory in Nottingham. The team found that most of the cattle grazed and lived near their final resting place. Some of the teeth from Earthlingborough had strontium ratios so similar that they might even have come from the same herd. But the results published in the Journal of Archaeological Science are not entirely straightforward, as Towers uncovered evidence that at least some of the animals recovered from the site were not born locally. The strontium ratio in the second molar of one animal from the Earthlingborough is higher than the characteristic range of values from the local area. This means that the cow or bull was born in a region with older rocks, for example the Malvern Hills, Wales, the Lake District, or even Scotland. But analysis from the third molar, which develops later, reveals lower strontium ratio values. This animal probably travelled to the area during its first year and then spent several months there before it was slaughtered. For the Gayhurst barrow, Towers found a tooth with the lowest strontium ratio recovered during her research. A possible origin for this animal is in an area rich in chalky rocks from the Cretaceous period, the closest one being about 25 kilometres southeast. While strontium isotopes cannot be used to pinpoint exact locations, they are useful to exclude Earthlingborough and Gayhurst as the original provenance of some of the cattle buried at the barrows. This means that local inhabitants must have exchanged cattle and communicated with distant groups. The carcass of an extinct steppe bison discovered 2 years ago melting out of a cliff in a remote village in the Northwest Territories is shedding new light on the Ice Age species and could rewrite the history of human migration in Canada as glaciers began retreating in the region nearly 14,000 years ago. An analysis showed the specimen was one of the last of its kind in ancient Beringia, the ice-free northwest corner of the continent that was once linked to eastern Siberia. But the rare find, documented by a team of Canadian, British and American scientists in the latest edition of the Journal of Quaternary Science Reviews, has wider implications for dating the retreat of the glaciers in northern Canada and the possible entry of human hunters from Asia, the ancestors of today's Aboriginal Canadians, into the continental interior. The partially mummified steppe bison was found 2 years ago in Sigechik. Sigechik. The animal's distinctive skull and wide horns were largely intact, but more tantalizing were portions of preserved limbs, hide and intestines that permitted detailed genetic analysis, allowing scientists to accurately situate the specimen in the evolutionary history of the North American bison population. Yukon government paleontologist Grant Zazula said that based on the genetics, this animal was one of the last remaining steppe bison in Beringia. Shortly after this, populations in the north are completely replaced by bison that had evolved in the mid-continent. What the find also shows is that the post-glacial ecosystem inhabited by the steppe bison must have supported large mammals earlier than previously known. That, say the scientists, suggests that human hunters may well have entered the area around this time and, potentially, left traces of their own activities at the site still waiting to be found by archaeologists. Given that steppe bison inhabited the northern portal to the ice-free corridor, the potential for discovery of archaeological sites in the lower Mackenzie River Valley is now increased. So, what's stopping you? Get looking. Let's hope that we actually report on some amazing new discoveries next year. And talking about the last of the steppe bison, it makes you think that Disney's going to bring out a film about this now, though it's very Bambi-like. Did Paleolithic man settle in what is now a place known as Thatcham? It's been claimed on numerous occasions that Thatcham in Berkshire, in England, is the oldest continuously inhabited place in Britain. It even has a place in the 1990 Guinness Book of Records as having the strongest claim. Whether this is true or not, of course, is still a hotly debated subject. However, there is evidence of human occupation within and around Thatcham, covering the past 13,000 years. Evidence for the Paleolithic Age, which ended around 10,000 BCE, consists of two hand axes found in the Lower Wey gravel workings in 1962. It's entirely possible that they did camp for brief periods in the area, but little evidence exists to support this. However, there is strong evidence to support the case that people settled in Thatcham in the Mesolithic period, between 10,000 and 4,000 BCE. There are a number of sites in and around Thatcham which were visited by people of this period. One of the most notable sites, which lies around the modern Lower Wey sewage works, was first unearthed in 1920, when workmen were carrying out levelling operations. During the excavations which followed, flint tools as well as animal bones were uncovered. They would have been using the river system for transport and even camping on the ancient lake shore, which would have covered the area back then. Like the Paleolithic people, they would have been nomadic. However, there is evidence to suggest that they did stay in the area for extended periods. In the Neolithic, between 4,000 and 2,500 BCE, there are few finds in the area for this period. However, there have been a few flints as well as hand axes found locally, usually on local farmland near the river. However, a few have been found on higher ground, namely Crookham and Greenham Commons, which indicate perhaps a shift away from the river system. Arguably, it's the Bronze Age between 2,500 and 750 BCE and the Iron Age between 750 BCE and 43 CE which makes Thatcham more notable than any other town in England and indeed makes Thatcham a nationally important place. Evidence for Bronze and Iron Age sites on the same land have been uncovered at Dunstan Park and Cooper's Farm. However, it's a site around Hartshill Copse that is exceptional. In 1986, field evaluation of Hartshill Copse by Oxford Archaeological Unit indicated a Bronze Age cremation cemetery and a dense settlement pattern. Excavations at the site later by Cotswold Archaeology in 2001 and 2002 found evidence for later periods, including Iron Age, Romano-British and medieval occupation. A later excavation found evidence of ironworking. Although Iron Age settlements had already been found in and around the site, this was different, because when the finds were dated, they were found to be around 1000 BCE, at least 250 years before the Iron Age was supposed to have started. Well, that actually reminds me of a great story I have, if y'all crave your indulgence, at Dreghorn up in Scotland. When we were doing a commercial evaluation in this little mining village across on the west coast, beneath we found some medieval backlots and settlement. Beneath that, we then started to find early historic occupation as well, including some industrial sites. And then it started to get interesting, because beneath that, we found an Iron Age roundhouse. Now, that's good enough, but no, it got better, because underneath the Iron Age roundhouse, we found a couple of Bronze Age houses. And then, unbelievably, beneath that, we found Neolithic. We found at least three Neolithic houses and possibly a totem pole hole right in the middle. So there's my claim to fame, is that up at Dreghorn in Scotland, we have a shot at being the oldest continuously inhabited village in Britain. Let the debate continue. An archaeological team has found more evidence of a site at St. John's Road in Trinidad that people lived there 7,000 years ago. The site is as old as that of the famed Banwari man, whose remains were found in Pinal 40 years ago. The two sites are about 5 kilometres apart, and proof of antiquity of the site has come, in part, from the research done by Dr. Basil Reed, senior lecturer with the Department of History at the University of the West Indies. Reed said that radiocarbon testing done in 1994 suggested that the South Oropushi site was dated to approximately 5000 BCE. Additional samples of shells collected at the site were recently sent to the Beta Analytic Inc. in Miami by the History Department's Archaeology Center. The results confirmed the findings that the site was indeed that ancient. The team of students also unearthed a sandstone adze, quartz and flint stone flakes, and red ochre. Some of the stone flakes may have been used by the Orotroroid natives as scrapers for food preparation, such as scaling fish, prying open shells, and removing the hides of the animals that they ate, such as the tree rat, the red howler monkey, the pacas, and the collared peccary. Reed said that the first two groups of migrants to the Caribbean were the Orotroroids and the Casmeroids. The Orotroroids probably migrated from the Guianas in South America, while the Casmeroids may have come from Belize. And if you think that was easy to say, then I suggest you get a lot of stone pages and try and say that group of names yourself. Modern humans, and of course this is an and finally story, and Neanderthals had sex across the species barrier, according to a leading geneticist who is overseeing a project to compare their genomes. Professor Svante Paabo, director of genetics at the renowned Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, will shortly publish his analysis of the entire Neanderthal genome using DNA retrieved from fossils. He aims to compare it with the genomes of modern humans and chimpanzees to work out the ancestry of all three species. Modern humans arrived in Europe from Africa around about 40,000 years ago to find Neanderthals already living there. The two species then coexisted for 10 to 12,000 years before the Neanderthals died out, a fact that has caused endless academic speculation about whether they interbred. Paabo recently told a conference that he is now sure that the two species had sex, but a question remained about just how productive it may have been. Paabo said that what he is really interested in is, did they have children back then, and did the children contribute to our variation today? He's sure that they had sex, but did it give offspring that contributed to us? We will be able to answer this question more rigorously with the new Neanderthal genome sequence. Such an answer might ease the controversy about recent contradictory discoveries regarding Neanderthals. Some fossils seem to have both modern human and Neanderthal features, suggesting that the two species interbred. Yet DNA scans have shown that Neanderthal genes were very different from those of modern man. Last week, Professor Chris Stringer, head of human origins at the National History Museum, presented at a conference at the Royal Society in London with the idea that they could accommodate both sets of evidence. It's possible that Neanderthals and humans were genetically incompatible so that they could have interbred, but their children would have been less fertile. Stringer added that he used to believe that Neanderthals were primitive, but in the last 10 to 15,000 years before they died out, around 30,000 years ago, Neanderthals were giving their dead complex burials and making tools and jewellery such as pierced beads, just like modern humans. Due to the length of time that's elapsed since Neanderthals became extinct, any trace of their DNA in modern humans could have been diluted below detectable levels. Pavel hopes to overcome this by scanning Neanderthal genome for the genes of modern humans. Well, there you go. Who says that archaeology is not sexy? And talking of sexy archaeology, why not get along to a few sites like Open Archive? You can find that at openarchive.co.uk. And there we're trying to create a new way for people to actually present archaeological reports and ideas that normally don't make it into the mainstream. Have also a look at voicesofthepast.org. That was Voices of the Past, that's all one word, .org. There are great friends there and have an amazing site to explore. And we're actually on the final edit of the Past Horizons magazine issue 10, which will be coming out in around about a week from now. You'll find that at www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. That's www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. And believe it or not, I seem to be getting around the Badger Federation now. So if you're interested in archaeology and you're in the UK, then there's only one site to go to. That is Badger. www.bajr.org. Of course, more can always be found at the fabulous Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. So thank you very much for listening to the Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return to us next week, and I hope I'll be here to read it for you. Thanks now.